You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Peter.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Yeah. How are you doing?
You know, exactly the same. That's quite the coincidence. I'm doing okay. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Peter Hessler, staff writer at New Yorker. You've written several books about China, the most recent of which is new, and we're going to talk about that. You were in Egypt for a while, I think during the Arab Spring, reporting for the New Yorker, and you wrote a book about Egypt, right?
Yeah, no, I was in Egypt for 5 years, from 2011 to 2016. So sort of during the, after the fall of Mubarak, but through the elections and all of the stuff that happened with the Muslim Brotherhood.
I see. Yeah. Okay, yeah. So during the coup. Maybe we'll have time to talk about that. I would love that. But the main thing we're going to talk about is Other Rivers, A Chinese Education, your new book. I really liked it and got a lot out of it because, the term unique vantage point is probably overused in book promotional material, for one thing. But this, you really actually do have a unique vantage point here because you taught in China at a college in the mid-late 90s. And then you taught at the college level again, like exactly a generation later, starting a couple of years before the pandemic. You were also in China, I think, in the aughts, for that matter. But the book is mainly about the comparison that this affords between your two kind of teaching experiences. So you taught a generation that was in college during a relatively liberalized era in China, and then you taught a generation that was in college after Xi Jinping had changed that quite a bit. And you also had kept in touch with a number of your first crop of students. And so you saw some of them when you were in China most recently and checked in with them. So, it's a really kind of a rich database. I really loved it. I listened to it. I didn't read it, but I think that counts, right? You can still say you read a book.
Definitely. Right? Yeah.
Okay. I wanted to start off with a question that's not about the book per se, but we seem to be in a period of a growing, in America at least, a growing antagonism toward China. To some extent, that's a matter of official politics. We're kind of embracing the idea of a Cold War. There also seems to be a lot of hostility to China at the grassroots level, at least more than I sensed 10, 20 years ago. You were in China when this was starting to really pick up momentum, which is kind of beginning the pandemic. That's not the exact origin point. The whole thing may be more gradual than I realize, but that's when I started to notice it. And I'm wondering, to what extent is it reciprocal? Has there been a growth in antagonism toward America among Chinese during the same period? And if so, is it clear, like, kind of who started it, so to speak? I mean, if either is the prime mover?
Yeah, I mean, it's always been a complicated relationship, right? I mean, I think ever since 1949, when the communists came to power, there's always been difficult relations with the United States. Of course, for many years, there were no relations at all. Even when I was there in the 90s, which in some ways was a more open era, China was focused on opening up to the outside world, it was often very tough to be an American there at that time. And there would be little spats, like something over Taiwan. I remember that something happened with the elections in 95, and that had led to a lot of tension. So there's always been ups and downs. But this is definitely a big down period. As far as to say who starts it, I mean, it's definitely true that in China, this is a very repressive regime. It's not as outward looking as it used to be. And that certainly contributes to the climate. But I think it's also true that in the United States, you sort of have both parties, whether you're Democrat or Republican, they both sort of see China as an enemy and tend to want to have policies that are as hard on China as possible. At the grassroots level in China, you know, when I lived there, I didn't feel that level of antagonism, to be honest. I think they're kind of used to it because the official rhetoric toward the United States has never been particularly positive. And I don't know, they just, I think, you know, your average Chinese person right now would probably say, we've got enough problems of our own to worry about. I'm not going to get that focused on things with the United States. That was kind of, that's sort of the feeling I got there on the ground. I noticed very few problems on the street. I mean, just sort of, or conversations like people targeting me. And it was actually more common in the 90s and aughts to have people would find out you're American and might get angry or might bring up something. It didn't happen as much from 2019 to 2021.
That's interesting. Now, it's true, as you mentioned, that your time there the first time around did overlap with a kind of a famous Taiwan Straits crisis that was really a big a point of friction. I forget how it started, but we made it a point of parading military ships through the Taiwan Strait in a way that drove them crazy. And so I'd imagine the government was not encouraging, you know, goodwill toward the U.S. at that point. But
yeah, and then in 1999, you know, there was the bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, which, you know, NATO said was accidental. The Chinese swore was not accidental. And this, you know, that was, you know, another spat that they blamed on the U.S. So these things would happen periodically. And, you know, they've happened throughout the last 40 years.
Yeah, that's a funny one because, you know, to Americans, including me, I assume it was accidental. I mean, I just assumed it. I didn't dream that it might have been intentional. But in China, it's almost the exact opposite, right? The assumption just was, well, they did this on purpose.
Yeah. They you know, that's really what, you know, that I think people to this day would believe that it was done on purpose. Yeah.
Yeah. I know you. You're on Kaiser Kuo's podcast, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
You know he was a rock star at that point. You know his whole history.
Oh, but yeah. No, I've known Kaiser since back in '99. We met in 1999 in Beijing. Yeah,
he told the story in my podcast that after that the bombing, he was being interviewed or something, and he referred to it as something like an unfortunate accident or something. I think accident was the word, and he got into like a heap of trouble. I don't mean official trouble, but like that was not well received.
It broke up his band. You know, he had a band with all Chinese members. And that, I think that was pretty much the thing that broke up that band and those, you know, strained those friendships to the point where they didn't continue. It was a big deal there. I mean, most Americans kind of hardly noticed.
Well, I guess that's true of a lot of things. And maybe it's vice versa. But did you get the sense in general while you were there that Americans kind of didn't have much of a clue as to like how actually the world is viewed from China and how America is viewed from China?
Yeah, I mean, certainly in 99, people weren't that focused on. I mean, I was, you know, it's funny when that bombing happened, I was actually in Nanjing. I was there visiting a friend. Nanjing's at that time kind of felt like a provincial capital, you know, like kind of a somewhat, you know, less connected part of the world. And it was funny because students started protesting after the bombing, the news of the bombing, but they didn't have any targets, you know, because there's no embassies there, there's no consulates. And so they went to the McDonald's and they were and there was a statue of Ronald McDonald on a bench that you could sit next to, and they started attacking the statue and they knocked it off. And in Chinese, you know, the name for him is Maidanglao Shushu, which means Uncle McDonald, you know, and they were chanting down with Uncle McDonald. And when I went back the next day to survey the damage, you could see like a little bit of his, you know, kind of the red plastic. I mean, I guess it's yellow plastic butt was still stuck to the bench. And that was all that was left of Uncle McDonald. So, you know, there were sort of comic elements in some ways because these places were in a way so disconnected or so distant. They're much closer now. I mean, the connections now, I feel like, are so intense that it's something weird about this relationship. Like, you know, people call it a new Cold War. You know, I have problems with that terminology because I think it calls to mind obviously the Soviet Union and you know, but this is totally different. I mean, you have almost 300,000 Chinese students in the United States every year studying at universities in America. You know, and it wasn't like we had hundreds of thousands of Soviet kids coming to the United States, you know.
Yeah.
And the you know, sort of the trade connections between these countries are so intense. There's so much contact that what we have is really something different. I think it's a little problematic to use that language because it sort of implies that there is a degree of separation that I think is exaggerated.
Yeah, I don't think you could have the kind of Cold War we had back then, even in the modern technological environment, because the degree of separation back then was so extreme. I mean, the Soviet Union was like a black box. You had no idea. I mean, as a citizen, you had no way of knowing what was going on in there. You almost never got any reliable reports about anything that was going on in there. And now just, I mean, you know, you've got smartphones everywhere. And so as long as there's an internet that's anywhere near functional, I mean, even if nations are trying to create walls within it of various kinds, they're succeeding. Everything, things are just much more transparent. But, and then as you note, the degree of commercial engagement with China especially is on a totally different level. So yeah, it's very different. I don't know how it's going to play out. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, I mean, you talk about that level of commercial contact. I mean, it is really, it's amazing when you see it from the Chinese side, like how much contact they have. Like I write about an internet entrepreneur. He sells like very inexpensive, basically kind of knockoff Nike, Reebok, whatever shoes on Amazon, mostly to American consumers. He was based in Chengdu in the southwest of China. And he tracks his sales data. He can see it so closely that he could tell, like, when the first, you know, stimulus checks went out to households in the United States in 2020, he immediately saw an impact on his sales. Immediately. You know,
He told you there's been a second round of stimulus, and you said, like, you don't know what you're talking about, man. But it turned out there had been a second wave of debit cards sent out from the first stimulus, right? And he had sensed that.
Yeah, I know. I was visiting him, because I visit him periodically, and he's like, yeah, they just sent out more checks. I was like, no, they didn't do that. You know, they only did one round. And I just figured he must have been confused or something. And I went back home, and like the day later, the person staying in my house in Colorado sent me an email and said, hey, by the way, we just got this debit card for you and your wife, this, you know. And it turned out the people that they didn't have bank information for, they were sending the round out then, but he had seen it. So then in a way, like, he knew that I got my check before I did, you know. Mm-hmm. That's how intense his contact is. And you do see a lot of this. This was somebody, he had never been to the United States, but, you know, he read English well enough to communicate with customers there and with shippers. And he followed things incredibly closely, you know, using Google Trends and all kinds of other online tools. So people there often can get a fairly sophisticated notion of whatever corner of America that they are in contact with or exploiting. So yeah, there's no comparison to what we're, you know, to what we had in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah. Do you have like a list of common misconceptions on the part of Americans, like about China or about the way, the world is viewed by Chinese, or America's viewed of China by Chinese, or, I mean, informal, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I think the political system is a big one, just in the sense that there is a sense that this is a very repressive state and that the party controls everything. And I think it's, when you live there, you see there's all kinds of holes in the bureaucracy, and there's much more chaos on the ground. It doesn't feel like it's not Orwellian necessarily. I mean, one of the guys I talked to in this book, an academic who studies China and studies grassroots political movements, he had a friend who had told him, is it more like Kafka or is it more like Orwell? And he said, I think it's probably still a little more like Kafka. And there are definitely moments that are like Orwellian, but it's not as if the party knows everything that's going on. And a lot of times it does feel like Kafka. There is this sort of, you know, the intense bureaucracy, and there's sort of inefficiencies and some comic elements to it as well. So I think that's something that Americans often get wrong. I mean, we tend to view it as this really monolithic state, and that all the people are just hopelessly repressed and have no idea what's going on.
Mm. Although, speaking of Orwell, on the one hand, Orwell's books were tolerated and you were allowed to teach, Animal Farm. And on the other hand, in your classroom, there was a camera, right? And for all you knew, at any given time, you were being monitored. And you ultimately, I hope this isn't a plot, you ultimately kind of got into a certain amount of quasi-political trouble yourself because of a complaint about, well, it's a long story, but anyway, people started complaining about you on social media as being, what was the complaint exactly? Anyway, this led to them to your leaving a little earlier than you would have liked. You would have liked to teach another year there on the second round of teaching, I mean, right? But yeah. The university felt the political heat and kind of said sayonara.
Yeah, I mean, it's they have this, you know, there are kind of two different things that happened. One is, you know, there's something the Chinese call jubao, which means to be reported. And this is a political reporting. This is a risk on campuses, for example. If you're a professor and you say something kind of, you make an offhand remark about Xi Jinping or something that's not politically kosher, there is a risk that you have a student who reports that to the administration and there can be trouble. It doesn't happen all that often, but it definitely happens. And it kind of weighs on people, even if it's not that common. And at better universities, there's a more of a risk because the students are kind of higher level and the professors are more freewheeling. And there was an incident where I was basically reported on social media for saying things that they said were anti-China. And it turned out that they had taken stuff from my comments on a student's paper. And then it kind of, they warped it in. I don't know who they are, but just somebody who posted this stuff turned it into a classroom debate where I supposedly had been kind of browbeating the students. It was all fabricated. But it was kind of scary when it happened because there were all these people commenting on Chinese social media. There were people on Twitter commenting on it. And I got called into the university. We talked about it. It turned out nothing happened. But that sort of thing is there. It's kind of like their version of cancel culture or whatever, you know, but very different in that it has this incredibly strong political, you know, side to it. And it's tied to the party. It's tied to the leadership, tied to Xi Jinping. The other issue was just that I was writing there. I was covering the pandemic. I went to Wuhan in 2020 and reported there. And there were some people, you know, in the Chinese government or in especially in Chinese nationalistic circles who didn't like what I was writing. And the university didn't offer me another job after I finished the spring semester in 2021. So my family came back to the United States.
Mm-hmm. And
this was also a time when journalists pretty much all the American journalists from the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal, most of them had been expelled by that point, you know, and so it's very hard to be in China right now as an American journalist.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of the pandemic, we had a little email correspondence, and you're leaning toward the natural origins hypothesis. You actually went to the Wuhan Sea Market in summer of 2020? So this is early on. And of course, in China, the things weren't out of control the way they were in America at that point because they were very, very locked down. But you actually visited the sea market. What are the things that make you skeptical of the lab leak hypothesis?
Well, there's basically two reasons. One of it is simply what the scientists believe, which is when you look at, you know, you talk to virologists, you know, outside of China and the top people in the field, they tend to be very negative about this lab leak theory. Just the patterns of spread, the nature of the virus. And I trust those people's work. But there's also a very strong China component that having been to Wuhan, having lived in China, that I tend to believe, which is also that, you know, if you go to Wuhan, like that Institute for Virology is nowhere close to that Huanan seafood market, right? They're totally across, you know, it's like at 8 miles and across two rivers. There's also just no natural overlap between those places. It's not like, I mean, I think in the imagined landscape of Wuhan, in the foreign mind, Wuhan consists of two things. One of them is the Huanan market and the other is the Institute of Virology. And everybody in Wuhan spends all their time going back and forth. But, you know, this is a huge city and it's a major crossroads. It's a, you know, big railroad crossing. This is where the revolution that brought down the Qing dynasty started in Wuhan. There's all kinds of stuff that has always happened in Wuhan. It's not that shocking that something like this would begin there. It's a crossroads. Mm-hmm. And there isn't really any reason for somebody from the Institute of Virology to spend time in the Huanan market. You know, that's a wholesale market. It's very, you know, has a very specific clientele. And the patterns of spread are so clearly point to that market. That you have to explain, well, why would it go from the institute to the market? The other reason for me is just that, as I mentioned earlier, things in China are not as controlled as people often believe. And if you look at the pandemic in the early stages, there were major leaks of information all the way along. I mean, ranging from Li Wenliang, the famous doctor who, you know, alerted some of his classmates, and, you know, he was in Wuhan and he was hearing about this virus that was spreading, you know, back at the in December of 2019. And he warned his classmates, and somebody took screenshots of that warning, posted on social media. He ended up getting in trouble. The genome, which was sent out in January, that the scientist who leaked that to the outside world did not get permission for that. He felt he had a responsibility to put that out. At every stage, you have a lot of things that came out, you know, that the government wouldn't have wanted to come out. And I have trouble believing that this, all these people working in the Institute of Virology, and this thing would have leaked out at some point, and then weeks later, it's blowing up in the city, and nobody at that institute has said anything. Nothing has leaked out. Nobody's, you know, warned a friend or, you know, that to me is also unlikely, not impossible. So that, you know, that's my view on it. It's not impossible. Like, until we know exactly what happened, we can't rule out possibilities, but the high probability is the natural origin connected to that market.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so why don't we kind of do a little of kind of running through the book chronologically. So you show up there as a Peace Corps volunteer in what, 96?
96,
and since then, by the way, President Trump has ended the American Peace Corps presence in China. I mean, among the other kind of casualties of the Cold War, whatever you want to call it. But you were going there to teach college, and had you studied Chinese?
No, I didn't. You know, I mean, I graduated from college in 1992, and you know, for my generation, it was very uncommon to have an interest in China or to study Chinese. It was actually more common to study Japanese, which also wasn't that common. But people didn't really see China as a promising place to go necessarily. And I never really thought about it. I just, you know, the first time I went there was actually, I went to graduate school in England. And on the way home, I went to the East and I traveled around the world and made this like 6-month trip. And I took, as part of that trip, I took the train from Moscow to Beijing. Just because I'd always wanted to take the Trans-Siberian train and went through Mongolia. And I really had no interest in China. It's just that's where the train ended. My idea was I'd get to China and go to Southeast Asia, which sounded better to me. But I arrived in Beijing. That was 1994. And something about it really struck me. I mean, you could just tell there was an energy there, you know, and I ended up staying in China for a few weeks traveling. And by the time I left on that trip, I had decided that, you know, I think I want to go back here and try to learn Chinese and, you know, try to see what I can do here. And so when I applied to the Peace Corps, I did ask to be sent to China, but I had not studied Chinese before I showed up there in 1996.
Mm-hmm. And your first Peace Corps gig there was teaching.
Yeah. So everybody was teaching at the Peace Corps, they would post us in teachers' colleges. And we were training young people who were going to become teachers of English in middle school and high school. And so this was part of this huge thing that you kind of only vaguely understood as a young person at that time, which was that China was trying to expand. It was trying to open to the outside world. And part of that, what they need is better English. But they also were expanding their education system on a massive scale at every level. And so they needed more teachers. So we were training teachers who would go back into these middle schools and, you know, teach English.
So it's part of the modernization drive, basically, the to educate a bunch of Chinese, including in English, so that there could be international contact. And what surprised you about the students?
Almost all of our students had come from the countryside. You know, China was still a very rural country. So most of that first cohort of students I taught, they had been born like in 1974. In 1974, the population was 83% rural. I mean, this was a really agricultural country. Most of these people were living on tiny farms. You know, often they're farming less than a sixth of an acre. It's really just bare subsistence farming. Many of them were living in poverty. Many of my students had parents who were illiterate, who had never been to school for one day. It wasn't uncommon for them to write about grandparents, grandmothers who'd had bound feet and things like that. So, you know, it was a sense that this past was still very much there. But these kids had done well in school and they were being pulled out. You know, they made it into college, which was rare. I mean, at that time, 1996, only one out of every 12 college age Chinese went to college. You know, so that's like 8%. So it was unusual, you know, and so these were smart kids from poor rural families who were coming to college. And you could kind of sense like they were going to become something different. They still often looked very rural. You know, they were noticeably poor. I talk in the book about how, I used to memorize their names. We had these big classes of almost 50 kids, and you could memorize their names by their outfits, you know, because they wore the same thing every day. You know, like there was a kid named Roger who always wore this like blue this bright blue suit jacket, you know, very cheap suit jacket with a tailor's label on the sleeve. And Roger wore that every day. And over the semester, I mean, that bright blue jacket got kind of dingier and dingier because, you know, they didn't have any clothes. If they wanted to wash their clothes, they had to wash them by hand. You know, it was a, you know, these people were still pretty marginal economically.
And then now the crop of students you taught like 20 years later, it was a different college and kind of a different demographic, right? So it's not quite an apples to apples comparison. Yep. At the same time, there were aspects of the experience that allowed you, that kind of reflected change that had taken place in China since your first time around, right?
Yeah. I mean, this, you know, for an example, I mean, yeah, so one of the biggest change is just how many people went to college, right? I mean, as, mm-hmm. as I mentioned, you know, in 1996, you're looking at 8% of young Chinese could make it into college. By the time I returned in 2019, that 8% had turned into 51.6%. I mean, that's kind of astounding. You know, it's, and, you know, for example, the college where I taught had 2,000 students. And when I left in 1998, they had 2,000 students. By 2004, they had expanded to 20,000, you know, like 10 times the enrollment. And that happens kind of across the whole system, basically, you know, because they're just trying to get more and more people educated. So it's pretty much unprecedented to have that sort of, you know, increase in higher education.
Uh-huh. And before,
so
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, and so, you know, the when I came back to teach in 2019, it's become suddenly most Chinese go to college, right? That's a big change. And most of them were no longer coming from the countryside. That country, you know, as I said, those country had been 83% rural when my first cohort of students was born. By 2011, the country had become majority urban, and by 2019, it was way urban. And so, actually, the first semester I taught at Sichuan University, not the same university as you mentioned, but the same region, my first year, my first semester, I didn't have one student who had grown up in the countryside. They were all city kids and pretty much all middle class kids.
Yeah. And then, I mean, the other weird thing, just as a kind of a tangent, is, of course, the one child policy, which had taken effect in the 80s. Is that right?
Yeah, but it didn't really, you know, that's the thing. It wasn't really impacting people in the countryside as uh-huh. much until later. It took a while. So actually, the kids I taught in the 90s had not really been affected. They were usually from large families. It's very common, three or four siblings in the family. I remember my last, so I had a cohort of freshmen who came in 1997, and I surveyed them. There's a class of about 30 kids, and there was only one only child in that class. Mm-hmm. So that showed that, like, it still hadn't quite hit the countryside. But then in the years to come, in the 2000s, the policy got stricter and stricter, and people moved to the cities where it was easier to monitor them, and you really began to have the very strict one-child families. And by the time I was at Sichuan University, almost all of those kids were only children. It was, you know, usually more than 90%. I would survey them every semester, and it was generally more than 90% had no siblings. And actually, when I asked them the question, first I said, do you have any brothers or sisters? And I learned after the first semester that when I asked that question, I had to say, because sometimes they say, I have three brothers. And I was like, and I'd ask them a follow-up. I was like, you have three brothers? He's like, well, and it turned out they were cousins. Like, they had just uh-huh. started to think of their cousins as siblings, because that was kind of like a substitute, or, you know, that was the version of siblings for this generation. So I'd have to ask that question, you know, this is not cousins, you know, this is your brothers or sisters, you know. So it's an incredible change, you know, in terms of family structures, family size, and also the pressures on kids, right? When you're the only child, and you're middle class and your parents have resources and they're somewhat educated, the pressures on you are very different than if you're coming from a farm family of, you know, four kids.
Uh-huh. And so now the government is trying to encourage childbirth and having trouble doing it, I gather. And that the fact that they're having trouble is, I got to some extent, a consequence of the one-child policy. Is that your take?
I think it's, yeah. I mean, it's partly because people have developed this pattern of having one child, but really a lot of it comes down to education, to be honest. It is so hard to go through Chinese school, and there is so much parental investment in that. And the investment, of course, is partly financially, but it's mostly time. You know, parents really spend an enormous amount of time monitoring their kids' homework, trying to marshal them into the right classes, into the right supplemental things. And it's exhausting. And young people don't want to have kids and put them through it. You know, so in that sense, it's similar, actually. South Korea is the same issue. You know, South Korea has plummeting birth rate. They never had a one-child policy. It's not because of that. Because of the same educational, you know, once you get to this highly competitive, when education becomes so competitive, then it sort of drives people away from having children. It's almost like, I don't know, in the U.S., if you know, like, elites in the U.S. who have kids, and like, if you're an elite private school in Manhattan or something, that can be really exhausting and pressure filled, right? Yeah. And I think, you know, you probably know people like that. I know people like that. But in China, that thing, that dynamic is true at kind of all levels, you know? So even when you go to very non-elite places, like in Sichuan province, you know, in some sort of third or fourth tier city, those kids are still have these incredible work routines around school, and the parents feel this incredible pressure. So I think that's the big difference. It's almost like you're taking this kind of very elite competitive framework, but it's applied across the entire educational system.
Uh-huh. And you had some direct experience with the educational system your second time there, because your kids, your twin daughters, attended Chinese school. And it's interesting because, I mean, as you said, the parents are very engaged. And in that sense, you might think they're like American parents, kind of helicopter parents. But one difference is the parents just pretty much never question the authority of the teachers, and they don't send any negative feedback to the whole teaching apparatus. That is a difference, right?
Yeah, no, it's a huge difference. I mean, you know, like, I was on this WeChat group for the class, and you're getting like 50 or 60 messages a day on this WeChat thing, and the parents are asking questions about homework, and they're interacting about all sorts of things. And I mean, during the 2 years, I never saw anybody give the teacher a suggestion or make a complaint on there. You know, it's mm-hmm. just, you know, the teacher is in charge. That's very much the message, very different from what you have in the United States. You know, you can just tell when you go to the parent-teacher conference in China. So when you go to the parent-teacher conference, first of all, it's all of the parents at once. It's not just you talking about your child. It's the entire class. Right. And you go and you sit in your child's desk, which means there's only one parent, you know, one parent per kid, because you've got one desk. Now, Leslie and I, my wife Leslie, you know, we have twins, so we were the only parents who both could attend these conferences, because we had two desks because our kids are twins. And you go in there, and it's kind of funny because the parents go in these, you know, they sit down in the child's desk, and their body language totally changes. Like, they sort of sit very much at attention the way Chinese students do. They're not looking at their phones. They're not messing around. They're just very serious. It's like it triggers something in the Chinese, you know, experience that you're in a classroom. You have a teacher in front of you. You pay attention. You do not interrupt. You don't ask any questions. And we went to these conferences every semester for 4 semesters, 2 years, and there was not one question asked by a parent. The teacher gives a presentation, talks about what's going on in the class, how their studies are going, things they need to work on. The parents, you know, gather the information, listen attentively, and that's it, right? So,
you know, the teacher doesn't say any questions?
No, teacher doesn't. The teacher doesn't want any questions, you know. And it's sort of funny because all those kids, you know, in some ways it's horrible, but in other ways you can see it's kind of like in the United States, like the parents give teachers so much crap, right? You know, and it's just, you know, often unfairly, right? I mean, my older sister was a school teacher. She finally quit, you know, like 3 years ago, because she just couldn't. She said that the lack of respect was just too much. It was getting worse over time. She couldn't deal with it. And it's interesting. So most of those kids I taught in Fuling in the 90s, it was a teacher's college, and most of them became teachers. The vast majority of them are still teaching. And I've done surveys with them, and it was interesting when I asked them to rate their job satisfaction, for example. The average response for those who was teaching was 7.9 on a scale of 1 to 10. So, I mean, they were very highly satisfied with their jobs. Very few had left the profession. I mean, more than 90% were still teaching. Like, you imagine if you looked at young teachers in America in 1996, how many of them would still be teaching now, right? It's not going to be 90%. And what's their job satisfaction going to be? I think it's not going to be 7.9 out of 10.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, it used to be different. I mean, when I was a kid long ago, you know, there was a lot less parent blowback. But that said, I'm sure, you know, there was no shyness. There would have been no shyness about a parent bringing up an issue with a teacher mm-hmm. about the student or anything like that. You know, it was during this part of the book that I wondered, like, or just thought, you know, when we hear about relatively authoritarian attitudes, you know, kind of like this, or just a greater respect for authority, I think there's a tendency to think, you know, this is communism at work or something. But actually, it must be hard to separate longstanding features of Chinese culture from the influence of communism, which, of course, itself has changed in nature a lot, and in fact is no longer communism, although that's still the name of the party. But it's a very authoritarian party, of course. I mean, did you think about that at all? Because you know, China is it's been an unusual civilization for a long time in a lot of ways. I mean, I don't think there's any other place where, you know, empires of that size, I'm talking about over the last couple of millennia, managed to stay intact for such long periods of time, you know, and like maintain control. That's like, that doesn't happen. Like Rome falls apart, the Islamic Empire falls apart. There's a lot more fluidity. And of course, they have this very ancient history of actual exams to see who gets to staff the bureaucracy that was abandoned finally, but only in the last century. Anyway, it's a kind of an open-ended question, but you must have found yourself trying to figure out, like, well, what part of this should we attribute to the current, you know, political regime, and what part to culture more broadly?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Confucianism has been around for a lot longer than communism, and you see the education system is reflecting those features, you know, and so it's definitely put, you know, and of course the party likes Confucianism to a certain degree, and they've pushed it through their Confucius Institutes and other, you know, other things. So yeah, it is a very deep cultural feature, and you feel it both in terms of things that are positive and negative, right? I mean, you can see a lot of the pressure, you can see the lack of people asking questions, but you also do see this kind of respect and this impressive education system. And I remember going to there was the U.S. before the U.S. consulate in Chengdu was closed. At one point, there was a party there, and all these diplomats were there. And I met somebody who was somehow connected to one of the embassies, Chinese person, and I started talking with her. And I said, my kids were in this school, Chengdu Experimental. And she's like, oh yeah, they have this teacher Bai is there. And I was like, yeah, Bai Lao, sure, yeah. No, she's oh yeah, we. And it's like this woman was like a celebrity teacher. She's like a third, fourth grade teacher that everybody in Chengdu kind of knows who this person is, because she's recognized as being such a phenomenal instructor. And you go to a diplomatic party and her name comes up, right? And it's sort of like, that's amazing, right? And that's a, you know, a good feature that these people have this level of respect, and it gives the teacher satisfaction. They do a better job as a result. I mean, so that's one of the things that we valued about being there. We liked having that contact with the educational system. Of course, there are all kinds of negative things too that you're processing and dealing with at the same time.
Okay, so like back to the chronology kind of. So you're teaching in the 90s. Students are rural. I sense that there was like a huge kind of hunger for contact with Western culture. I mean, throughout, there's always this consciousness of like American sports and stuff that surprises me, right? Like were Air Jordans or fake Air Jordans or something a popular thing in the 90s? Or
I mean, in some ways they were kind of too poor for even fake Air Jordans, you know. What they used to have was they had like knockoff Bulls jerseys. Everybody wore that, you know, 96 to 98. All the boys had these kind of cheap Chicago Bulls jerseys. Yeah, they were into the basketball.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And an interest in the whole American way of life, right? I mean,
yeah, I mean, it was very, you know, their knowledge was low, right? I mean, when we were there in the 90s, we didn't have internet. None of those kids had been on on the internet. No email. We didn't have phone, you know, cell phones. So the information was really scattered, you know, and they would get these kind of bits and pieces of things. But yeah, they were eager to try to connect and to try to learn more about the outside world. And they were leaving poverty. These young people did not want to go back to the village. I mean, they were, mm-hmm. you know, they were going somewhere different from what their parents had experienced. And that was another thing that was striking for that generation, was this generational divide was so immense. And many of them wrote me in the years later saying things like, our parents didn't know how to raise children. They raised us like they raised pigs and chickens. They were peasants. They were uneducated. And they, you know, so they, and then once these kids were off into this to become teachers and in the cities, they could get no guidance from their elders, you know, because the elders were farmers and people who had not been educated at all. So they just, it's like this line had been drawn, and they were on the other side, and now it was time to build a new life. And that was, you know, I think in many cases a stressful and initially traumatic experience, but they all kind of did it. It's amazing. All of those kids I taught became middle class. You know, they all became urban residents. And you could see a whole generation of people making this transition.
And then when you went back to teach, like a couple of decades later, what were the most striking like contrasts and continuities?
I mean, one of the things I write about early in the book is just the physicality of the students, right? When I taught, you know, you mentioned the Air Jordan, all this, because we used to play basketball. And I mean, and, you know, I'm 5'9", but that was big. You know, like I was a tall guy there, and I'd always been a point guard in, you know, in America. And then in China, I was like a, you know, a point, I was like a center point guard. You know, it was like Magic Johnson or something, you know, because that was like, and the other guy who was with me was like 6'1", 6'2", and he was just a monster. You know, they were amazed, right? So these kids were tiny, you know, and I used to, when I went back to Sichuan University and taught in 2019, I would show pictures from my first semester teaching in the 90s. And the students would just laugh because I was towering over these students. And meanwhile, and when I show them that picture, then I'd have a kid stand up in at Sichuan University, and he would be like, you know, 3 inches, 4 inches taller than me. You know, and you know, the Lancet actually published a study in 2020 that said that out of 200 countries, over a study that had been going on since 1985, China had seen the largest increase in boys' height and the third largest in girls' height. So the average 19-year-old Chinese male was now 3.5 inches taller than he had been. I mean, just because of the nutrition. And that's like, you feel that, you know, as a teacher, of course, the physicality of your students, you notice. I mentioned those kids were tiny, they wore the same clothes every day, and then suddenly I'm back there 20 years later, and half the boys are taller than me, some of the girls even are taller than me, they're wearing nice clothes. You know, it's that really strikes you at a very visceral level. I mean, we hear that like 800 million Chinese, you know, escaped poverty, or left poverty from the reforms, after the reforms in 1978 to now. And that number's kind of meaningless. Like, what is that? You know, it's very hard to grasp what that means. But when you're there in the classroom and you see that physical difference, then you start to get a different perspective on it.
Now, that is amazing. And it's just attributable to nutrition, right? Like on that and healthcare broadly. But
yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, one of those kids I taught in the 90s, I mean, he wrote me later, like he wrote me almost 20 years after he'd been my student, and apologized for not having been a very good student. And I mean, he was a perfectly nice kid. I remember he was sort of low energy and one of the kids who occasionally would fall asleep, but he wasn't anybody who stood out in terms of being a bad student. But he wrote this apology and he said, you know, for 1 year, I could only eat one meal a day. Mm-hmm. You know, and you realize that's why the kid was sleeping in class. He was starving. You know, he was just, you know, exhausted. He was malnourished. And he said, but now I'm happy about my life. I'm a happy man now. So, you know, this is again, like this idea of poverty, which most of us as Americans don't really grasp. Like, you did get a different perspective if you were there in the 90s and you knew these people well, and then you saw how their lives went after that.
And so when you, you know, you stayed in touch with some of these students and you even saw some of them during your second teaching experience there, you looked them up. What kinds of things were they doing, and what was the level of, were they all like pretty happy with the direction of things or?
Yeah, I mean, they were very, because I always often ask them, you know, how do you feel about your life, or how optimistic are you about the future? And all these, and they tend to be a very happy, very optimistic cohort. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense. I mean, as I say in the book, like they didn't really have any advantages in terms of where they were born. I mean, they usually came from very remote, very poor places. Their families were not connected, but their timing was just perfect, right? Because they were born usually 74 to 76, around the time that Mao Zedong died. He died in 1976. The reform started in 1978. It meant that these kids grew up with those economic changes, and they just like caught that wave, you know. So they, you know, just by virtue of working hard, studying well, they were in position to benefit, and they really all did. I mean, when I survey them, all of them are, you know, middle class now. And there were some, now most of them became teachers, which means that they have good incomes, but they're not hugely rich, but they usually have, you know, a couple of apartments, they've got cars, they live well. The ones, there are some who went into business, and a lot of those guys did phenomenally well. Because again, the timing was so great, and you could mm-hmm. find a niche, you know, in the 90s and the 2000s, you could find some product and catch that wave, you know, and just make millions. I mean, some of them, you know, there's one of the guys I write about that I, you know, he was a poor kid from a village. And when, it, you know, one thing led to another and he ended up, I go back and visit him in 2019 and he's driving me around fooling in a, you know, a Mercedes 500 series, you know, it's like a $150,000 car. You know, it's you know, unbelievable. This kid that I remember as being, you know, really poor.
Yeah. And then so the second cohort of kids, of course, you haven't seen them grow up yet. I mean, you haven't seen them 2 decades after college yet. But are you already sensing like different trajectories, attitudes?
Yeah. No, it's so different. I mean, that first cohort, like the challenge was pretty immense in a way, like, but it was very clear cut. Like, you wanted to become educated, you wanted to move to the city and become a city person, you wanted to improve your material circumstances. And those are big challenges, but they were very attainable. And you could see the path, you could see. And so they locked in, they got the target, and they worked hard and they made it. And huge numbers of people from their generation did that. But for young people now, you know, most of the ones I taught were already middle class. You know, they weren't growing up in poverty. And I think there was more question about, well, what's the goal now? You know, I mean, some of them wanted to make more money and just become richer and richer. But a lot of them were trying to figure out, you know, is there something else we should be working for? Is there something else that we should prioritize? And meanwhile, they're coming into adulthood in a, you know, a climate that's been tightening politically. And also economically, like they're not the same kind of opportunities. It's not wide open like it was in 1998. You can't just go out and find some unexploited niche and have no education and then just, you know, boom, you become a millionaire. That doesn't happen very often in China now.
Yeah.
So they feel a different type of pressure. But I think there's a lot of confusion. One of them actually wrote me, I quote her in the book, she's, you know, like, we are a confused generation. And I could tell that, you know, I could see that a lot in my interactions with them.
It's funny. The one time I've been in China was it 2010, or it was kind of shortly before the Xi era. And by the way, you described the dynamism you felt when you went there in the 1990s. I felt like this is the place to be in the world. Like, you know, there was so much vibrance. And I had lunch with some American journalist whom I didn't know, but I had been kind of connected with, and he's like, it's great here. It was him and his wife. And it's like, this is great. I was thinking, like, if I were a little younger, I'd move here. Of course, then things changed. But what I was going to say was, I was there to give a talk at this conference on positive psychology, which is, I don't need to get into what exactly it is, but there was a real interest. Like, some of us who were there went on TV and they were asking us questions. There was a real interest in, like, okay, once you get fairly affluent, how do you find meaning, right? It was like you could sense that question in the air. Obviously, because of the nature of our what we were there for, the question is going to get directed to us, but it really, you can tell that the government seemed to be engaged in a search for ways to make sure that people would still be happy, you know, however ironic this sounds, they would still be happy once they had money, right?
Yeah. No, this is, that was also striking to me, the students I taught in the 90s, they always impressed me as just incredibly atheistic. I mean, they had been very much indoctrinated by the Communist Party. Most of their villages, the temples had all been torn down or were, you know, turned into something else. And, you know, I actually avoided bringing up religion at all in my classroom, not so much because it was sensitive, but because the kids were so mocking of it that it just, I found it kind of, you know, just, it was sort of demoralizing. And I just found it depressing because they weren't totally closed-minded about things like that. And you couldn't really have a conversation. But it was really amazing because in 2016, when I surveyed that group of students, I did a survey that year that sort of focused more on faith. And I asked, you know, some very direct questions because, you know, we've been in contact for a lot of time. They've all read my earlier books. I have a very good relationship with these young people and they trust me, right? So I can ask them things and I really trust their responses because they know they can be honest and they know how I use the material, what I'm doing as a researcher. And that year when I surveyed them on faith, I asked, you know, do you believe in God? And it was amazing to me that 82% said yes. Totally. I would never have expected that in the 90s. I asked how many of them believed in Bao Ying, which is karmic retribution, you know, the Buddhist idea that, you know, if you do good things happen to you, bad things come mm-hmm. back to you as well. And 85% believed in that, you know, just overwhelming majority. And I said, you know, have you visited a place of worship in the past year? And 70%, that's a high number, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know, you know, if you surveyed students in the United States that you taught 20 years ago, would they be going to church or temple, you know? So it's interesting. A lot of that stuff, even though the communists stamped it out, the roots were deeper, you know, and it does kind of, it still exists at some level and it comes back in different ways. And definitely during this generation when, you know, your material needs have more or less been satisfied, people are interested, you know, what else is there? And the party's cut off, you know, civil society, right? You can't get involved in neighborhood groups or school groups or, you know, all kinds of organizations that might occupy your attention and energy in the United States. Right, all of that space is really laid waste by the party. You know, they want to control everything, so it's hard for people to find something.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. My last book was on Buddhism, and it was a defense of just kind of Buddhist philosophy and meditative practice, kind of secular Buddhism, naturalistic Buddhism, not mm-hmm. religious Buddhism, which, of course, is much of what Buddhism is in Asia. It's much more religious than Americans realize. But it's really sold well in China. It sold like 180,000 copies in China, and it's still selling in Chinese. And
oh, yeah, there's books on. I mean, there's a specialist on Taoism, an American guy who, you know, he was like a scholar, and he lived in like near poverty in the United States for decades. And then the book started to be translated in China. Now the guy, like, you know, he drives a Mercedes, I believe. I have a friend who's friends with him. He was driving either that or BMW, but I mean, it's all from Chinese royalties because they're really interested in these questions. Yeah, so that's
and
definitely
I think,
true.
I'm assuming they kind of like the idea that Buddhism is getting a kind of vindication from Western science, which is kind of a theme of my book, even though, again, I'm not really talking about the religious part. So when they say they believe in God, by the way, is that, what is the word, Chan, that the icon for, like, heaven? You know what I mean? The is this ringing a bell? Is there a word that's spelled T-I-A-N?
Yeah, Tian is heaven. Yeah,
Tian. Is that the word for God?
Not for God. It's like Shangdi is usually what they would say for God.
Okay.
Shangdi. Yeah, yeah. Although it depends on the religion, they have different terms for it. But I asked them in English and in Chinese for those surveys. You know, so and they would understand that when I say God in English, that, you know, we're kind of talking about this broader sense. Yeah, yeah.
And there are a fair number of Christians, although the church has to be kind of state sanctioned.
Yeah. There's, you know, I think the big difference, it still is quite different than our view of religion, right? I mean, our view of religion is that you belong to one religion and you commit to it, right? And the thing in China that was always part of the Chinese experience traditionally was that you could do everything, right? You could go to the Buddhist temple, you go to the Taoist temple, you go to the Confucian temple. You didn't have to commit to just one, right? And that was why Catholics ran into trouble there, because they would, you know, when they started converting people, they say, well, you can no longer worship your ancestors. And then their response is, well, why not? I can do all the Catholic things. Can I do the other things too? And you know, Catholics oppose that. And that always limited their success in China. But it's fascinating. I could kind of see that even with those former students, because some of them, when I had that survey on religion, like for example, one student wrote, you know, I'm interested in Christianity. I would like to go to a Christian church, but my town doesn't have a Christian church. So I have to believe in the Chinese God. You know, it's sort of like, this is what's accessible to me is the Buddhist temple. So I'll go to the Buddhist temple, even though I'm really interested in Christianity. It's not that important to them, right? You know, sort of which branch they're doing. It's a much broader view of religion, you know, not exclusive in the way that we would tend to see it.
I think it's the same way in Japan. You might have a Shinto wedding and a Buddhist funeral or whatever. Mm-hmm. And for that matter, you know, when Christianity really got off the ground in Rome, it was unusual for being exclusivist. And I think maybe that was a kind of a competitive advantage, because once you had recruits, like, they were completely devoted to spreading your message. But it was surrounded by these religions that permitted, kind of promiscuity, so to speak, metaphorically. And so it was unusual at a time. But yeah, it's I guess it worked. You know, what we normally do with the podcast, as I mentioned to you, is, you know, most of the conversations with the public, then we go into what's called overtime and continue talking. That is available to Non-Zero Newsletter members, and you can become one by going to the Non-Zero Newsletter Substack site And after that, you can create a podcast feed that will always give you access to these parts of the conversation. But before we do that, I just wanted to give you a chance. I've kind of jumped around. I would like to give you a chance to just say things about the book you would like to say. I want to keep talking about it in overtime. But I'd also like just to give you a chance of the things you most like to emphasize, the things you hope people will most take away from it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the main, you know, one of my main goals there as a writer was to give people an alternative to the narratives that we have about China, you know, and which at this point are becoming pretty impersonal, right, and highly political. And I think it is really important to remember the ways in which people are living on the ground and the thing, you know, the how they think, the attitudes of young people like the ones I was teaching at Sichuan University, the attitudes of the people I taught in the 90s, how their lives have changed. I think we're sort of losing that perspective because everything has become so political, and also just because we don't have very few American journalists and writers living there. It's very hard to live there now politically, you know, as a foreigner and to write about the place, which is really a shame. I think it's important, though, because we are in this moment that's quite repressive. The government there is you know, definitely more repressive than it's been in recent decades. But we can't ever say for sure where this is leading, because it was strange to live there as a teacher, because you're also very impressed by people's awareness. The young people I found really impressive in terms of how much they knew. They definitely were getting around the firewall. They were getting good information. They traveled overseas. They were very engaged, you know, I found them, you know, just a joy to teach. And I don't, you know, I'm not completely convinced that this system sustains the way it is, you know, indefinitely, right? And I think we always have to remember that we don't know where this is going. And when you talk about a society that has gone from 8% of people going to college to 51.6% in the span of one generation, that's a good thing, right? And those people are capable. And I think one thing that they're capable of is change. And, you know, I do think this is something Americans have kind of lost sight of, that you know, that there is this, there are positive things in China as well. And, you know, one guy who mentioned to me is like, it's like the water's frozen, but beneath the surface of the ice, there's a lot of movement. There are things going on. You just can't see it. And I think sometimes that's a good way to think about it. And to be open to the fact that, you know, we may be in a better place with China in 10 years, 20 years.
Yeah. And you note, I think, at the end of the book that among that second cohort, Xi Jinping doesn't actually seem to be super popular. I mean, he's not kind of lionized the way other Chinese leaders might be or might have been. And
yeah, I mean, now in the 90s, my students would write about Mao Zedong and Deng. I mean, Deng Xiaoping was still alive when I moved to China in 1996. And my students wrote about these people all the time. They were in essays and they'd come up in class. And it was amazing because toward the end of my time in Sichuan University, I sat down at one point. I was like, has anybody ever mentioned Xi Jinping in class? I couldn't think of a single time when a student had brought up his name. And when I looked through papers, like 500 papers I reviewed, it was like his name came up something like 22 times, usually just in passing, you know, like, and this is partly because they're afraid, right? Because they know that you can get in trouble if you say something wrong. So just don't touch it. Just don't talk about it, right? But it's also just, they're just tired of hearing about it. You know, it's like they hear so much. They got to go to all these Xi Jinping classes. The last thing they want to do is bring them up in my class, you know? So I definitely felt there's like zero affection from the average young educated Chinese for this figure. There's fear, definitely, but there's not affection.
Yeah, and you know, there were a number of students who were still kind of interested in causing trouble, so to speak. Now, you were disproportionately in touch with them because you were involved with the journalism program or whatever it was. There was a periodical called Common Sense that they put out, named after the Thomas Paine version. But you know, you saw the spirit of, you know, kind of crusading, crusading journalists alive in them, even if it seemed that once they got out of college, you know, most of them were resigning themselves to the status quo and getting on with the business of trying to, you know, have a good life. Still, you see the spirit alive in the students.
Yeah, no, there is this kind of tension because they're aware. They want something different. They want something better. But at the same time, they're intensely pragmatic. They feel all this pressure from being the only child. They feel like they can't take a risk and throw things away. They also know that the system is brutal to people who resist in various ways, and they're wary of that. You know, so they're not idealistic in the way that I often think of as young people. I mean, one way I describe in this book is how in the 90s, I always thought of the students as seeming very young. Those kids who were coming from the countryside, they're kind of wide-eyed. You know, it's like deer in the headlights a bit. They were in this new world. They're trying to make this adjustment. They sometimes came across as somewhat childlike. And my co-teacher, Adam, and I were always having to remind ourselves, no, these kids have had complicated lives. This is just the way that they're presenting themselves or the way that we sometimes see them. But 20 years later, when I went back to teach, I described them as old souls, you know, because they just sort of seem a little bit jaded, you know, a little bit, not exactly cynical, because that's such a negative word, but they're very realistic about how the system works, what their possibilities are, what their options are. They're pragmatic. You know, they're not like the idealistic kids who say, let's go change the world. I mean, sometimes they would like to do that, but they know their limitations.
Yeah. And I think the value of presenting them as you do, as just like these real people, remarkably like us, is, you know, however different the system may be, is just that, you know, it's kind of funny when you listen to the way hardcore China Hawks talk, they kind of divide their time between saying that their hawkishness is on behalf of the poor oppressed Chinese people and kind of implicitly demonizing the Chinese people, you know, and, like it can't be both ways. Right. And like, what worries me is I just don't see how growing tension, between the U.S. and China, winds up being good for, the Chinese people that most people at least sometimes report to care about.
Yeah. And I think, you know, sometimes we're looking in the mirror a little more than we might realize. Right. I mean, so we tend to see China through the lens of the military. Right. And we have a very militaristic view of China now. But the truth is, like, the United States is a very militaristic society, you know, and China is really not. Right. I mean, this is not a society. I mean, it's kind of, you know, I talk about those kids I taught in the 90s who became middle class urban. I think I know one whose kid has something. He went to a military college, but he's not in the military. Like, you don't aspire in China to send your kid into the military. It's nothing. No elite or person who's like highly educated would ever want their kid to do that, right? But in America, I mean, I could go to Princeton University. I knew lots of kids at Princeton who were going to go to the military. You know, it's a way to rise in America. It's a way to become politically powerful. It really isn't the same in China. Like, it's a very different type of society. So that's always been my view also on sort of the Taiwan issue. So it's like, this has not been a society that for the last 40 years, the military has not been driving their policy. Now, it often drives our policy in the United States, but it has not been the pattern in China. And that doesn't mean that you want to just ignore everything and pie in the sky and think it's all about peace. But there is something important about that pattern, right? If you're observing the way a society addresses problems, how they deal with things, if they have not been turning to military solutions to a high degree, then there's probably cultural reasons for that, right? And it indicates that they're less likely to look to that. And that's always been my view on China, is that they tend to be very pragmatic. They also don't like risk. You know, and you can see that with COVID, right? I mean, part of the reason why they had a very good COVID strategy in early 2020, you know, like in March and April, was that they were very cautious, right? And the people themselves were cautious. The government was cautious in its policy, but also, like, that wasn't the period of the terrible lockdowns. People in my town could actually go out and walk around, but they didn't. They were careful. Mm-hmm. But then when China made these mistakes in the later stage of where they did have those brutal lockdowns after the vaccines, when they should have changed, again, it was kind of their response was just, let's be careful. Let's do everything the same way we've been doing it. Like, there is this instinct toward caution that I think runs throughout the leadership. And that, to me, also argues against them doing something dramatic in the Taiwan Straits, because I think they understand that there's cost to that, right? You know, so I do think this whole thing has gotten exaggerated, and it is driven in part by the militarism in the United States. And while we should be prepared for things like this happening, we also have to be prepared for things that might have more diplomatic solutions or economic solutions. And our diplomatic and economic ties with China are important and deserve investment, right? I mean, you know, you look at I mentioned there's like 300,000 Chinese students in the United States. I think there was like, up until recently, there was 1,000 American students in China. You know, I mean, that is just crazy. I mean, that's, and I don't care if you're a militarist or a hawk or whatever, like that is not good for the United States. Whether you love China or hate China, like you're not going to have any good information if you're not having people learning Chinese and living there on the ground. And so that, you know, is very short-sighted. So I think, you know, we're talking about Cold War and freezing all kinds of relations and all this, but we're not getting, you know, the expertise that we're going to need in the next generation.
And that's more a reflection on us than them. In other words, the students could go there if they wanted.
They're making it hard, but recently the Chinese have been, I think they would like more students. Yeah, no, I mean, we could find ways to get people, you know, you can do that. It's hard for like the journalists now, right? And that problem has not been solved. So if you, for American journalists to get over there and get a resident visa is still complicated, difficult. It's a hard thing to do. But you can study there, definitely, you know, and we should be finding ways to encourage young Americans to do that. You know, it's worth it. You know, it's a smart investment. And it's something like, you know, we cut off the Fulbright program to China. We cut off the Peace Corps. I mean, those were incredibly stupid moves. The Peace Corps was great for the United States. Like they sent, I mean, I was in a group of, I think there were 14 of us, and three of us ended up writing books about China, you know, and becoming, one of them is a correspondent for NPR. The other guy worked for Newsweek. Now he's a diplomat. And another volunteer from that group, the guy Adam, who was with me in Fooling, he ended up working for the State Department. I mean, this was like a great training ground. It got Americans this intense contact at the grassroots in China. You could learn very quickly. You know, you could become some sort of an expert in the span of only 2 years. You know, I wrote a book after only 2 years there. And that was, you know, of great benefit. It was great. It was beneficial to China, too. I mean, I think it was good for those students. It was good for those towns. But it was really good for us, you know, as Americans as well. And cutting that off was incredibly short-sighted. I mean, but that was done by the Trump administration. And it just, there was no sort of due process to it. Nobody was really talking about the possible costs or benefits. I mean, it was all driven by senators like, I mean, Rick Scott, you know, when he was a senator from Florida, he was one driving that. And when I called and interviewed him, you know, I asked him, have you ever talked to a Peace Corps volunteer in who served in China or anybody who's serving there now? And he hadn't, neither him nor his staff. And he wasn't aware that I was a Peace Corps volunteer. I mean, God, if I get contacted by an American journalist who's going to interview me and a senator, I think I'd at least look at the guy's Wikipedia page, right? I mean, it's this is sort of lack of interest, lack of curiosity, lack of preparation when we deal with China is shocking.
No, it's I agree. It's troubling. I think, is he the one who also said that his research had shown that no Peace Corps volunteer had ever gone into the State Department or something? And that turned out to be like way, way, way wrong.
Yeah. And I said, no, there's actually been like 45 of them. I had the number at hand. And he's like, oh, nobody told me that. But you know, he didn't look very hard, right? And, and you know, and I said, would that have changed your view? And he's like, I don't know. I'd have to think about, you know, something like this. But yeah, it's just people who come from a place of total ignorance are contributing to our China policy. And that just shouldn't be tolerated.
Yeah. And then what was the name of the Uber China hawk in the administration? Peter, was it Peter? Wasn't Peter Navarro?
Navarro was a big hawk. So was Matt Pottinger. Was
oh, that the, guy.
Yeah,
so, and he's so still with us.
He worked with my wife. My wife worked with him at the Wall Street Journal. Yeah, I knew him. Very nice guy in person, but I think his policies are terrible.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you mentioned that you wrote a book after a couple of years there. I think that was Rivertown, right? And with other rivers, your latest, and you also wrote Oracle Bones, also about China, and Country Driving, and then you have a book about Egypt called The Buried. So people should read all of those, but first the one we're talking about. Now we will go into the aforementioned overtime.